Hi, welcome to A Mathematical Basis for Reality.
Briz, I think you should tell them that Physical Truth is a book on mathematics and philosophy, and that it's a good story.
Yeah, okay, so we got to deal with Schrodinger's equation. I've been thinking quite a bit how I'm going to approach this, and Roxy has been telling me that I've got to find some sort of segue to be able to get into and bring up and discuss Schrodinger's equation. This episode is very, very mathematical. It's got equations all over the yin-yang. And anyone who understands or lives with applied mathematics will understand the consequences of what I'm talking about. I'm using straight solving Schrodinger's equation by separation of variables. This was done by Schrodinger in his 1935 paper when he presented the thing. And basically he used characteristic functions, the time-ordered characteristic functions, the spatially-ordered characteristic functions. And there are consequences to them, and there's consequences of the boundary conditions. And basically we end up deriving Heisenberg from Schrodinger's equation, which are Heisenberg's the boundary conditions of Schrodinger's equation, which makes total sense. It makes total and complete sense. Physically and also mathematically, it's what it is. You can derive it straight from the mathematics. And that's part of what I have to do is find some sort of segue to go into it.
Okay, so Briz.
What does Schrodinger's equation mean to you?
No, listen. What? I've been away for a while.
Yeah.
And while you were gone, you did something about Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you did something about John Paul Sartre.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're looking at something by Cameron Rhode about artificial intelligence.
Yeah, we may talk about...
Okay, so wait a minute.
Reality in a virtual world with artificial intelligence. Sorry. Yeah, go on.
So, I'm just wondering how this all fits together with your book. Because I know that in your book you're going step by step to develop your philosophy and your mathematics, that and you're going somewhere with this. But what has Jane Austen and John Paul Sartre and artificial intelligence have to do with the book Physical Truth, A Mathematical Philosophy? And where are we going with this, and how does it all fit together?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question, as always. I was going to do Schrodinger's equation, but it's obviously we're headed towards artificial intelligence, which Cam did a wonderful recording on artificial intelligence. And I was saying, with artificial intelligence, where is reality and what is real? We're talking about truth. My idea of truth is equivalent to reality, and reality I'm defining as within the boundary conditions of Schrodinger's equation. And I was going to do stuff with Schrodinger's equation. But okay, artificial intelligence. Is it real that we have life forms that can evolve? And if something can evolve and is Darwinian in what's called a path-dependent state, does that mean that is a real thing? Is this life like real in the form of life? Or is it just artificial or not real, if you like, because it's virtual, it's living in a virtual space? This I find very fascinating. So if we're looking at reality, do we define reality as in the physical world defined by Schrodinger's equation? Because when we get into virtual reality, there's no Schrodinger's equation. It's ones and zeros, okay? It's ideas, concepts, and these are things that do very real things and interface with the reality of this world, such as a stock exchange, buying and selling stocks, and being able to accumulate capital, being able to take investments and tell which investments work, which ones don't, and other things like that, and evolving within that particular space. So we could take this blockchain technology and also turn that into a life form. Is this real? Is this a form of reality that we're witnessing the birth of some sort of different type of reality that is really just a virtual reality? And what does truth have to do with it? Because we see without the integrity of the blockchain, these artificial life forms, these virtual life forms, we'll call them, these virtual life forms cannot exist. They cannot survive without the integrity of something, and it's finding integrity with the blockchain.
So truth has to do with integrity.
Wow.
I want to know what specifically the Jane Austen talk has to do with reality and the truth and all these things that you're talking about in your book. So what was that talk about in relation to physical truth?
Okay, I'm talking, Tara brought in feminism. And she brought in feminism through Jane Austen,
right,
at that time. Because we're talking about the age of Mary Shelley, for example. Mary Wollstonecraft?
Yeah, Mary Shelley.
I'm talking about Mary Shelley and her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft.
Wollstonecraft.
And Paul Godwin.
Yeah.
This, when they were starting at the, near Godwin, yeah, near the end of the, near the end.
And, 1600s.
No, end of the 1700s. Near the end of the 1700s.
Oh, right. That's what we're just getting into the French Revolution and all that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Jane Austen, after the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, and we then have Pride and Prejudice, and a look at ordinary British life, very much in terms of reality.
Right.
Tara is saying Jane Austen was very much in tune with truth to write what the writer knew about. And since she knew about living in England and the area which she lived, this was the way people lived. That's what she wrote about and human interactions at that time. And she talked about truth from a female point of view, not from a feminist, but from a woman's point of view at that time, at that level of society, living that life. That's what life was like. That was the reality of it. But everything was very true. There was integrity. There was virtue and vice and purpose. And things were described within her world, but it was described from her point of view as a woman.
I agree. But what I am trying to say is that in all of these stories, I see that we're talking about truth, and we're talking about integrity, we're talking about virtue, we're talking about a lot of things, which is all very interesting. But I'm still keep going back to your book, Physical Truth. And in your book, Physical Truth, you go, as my understanding is, that you go step by step to a conclusion. And I'm just trying to figure out how these things are being woven in to physical truth.
Okay, that's a fair question. I'm looking at my premise. Let's go back to the premise or actual thesis, which is the truth is real. Okay, the truth is objective. It is not subjective. The truth is objective. What does that mean? I'm not talking about a religious point of view, but in a philosophical point of view and in a scientific point of view, what does it mean if truth is real? If truth is real, goodness would be independent of social norm. That there would be virtue would be independent of social norm. It would mean we were talking about things like artificial intelligence or extraterrestrial life. Would they have to adhere to the same rules of integrity that we are trying to approach and discover in ourselves, in our world? It seems they do. It seems they do. And what I'm saying is that there is a mathematical point of view that we can derive a conclusion that says the truth is real. If the truth is real, what about love, for example? Is love real? Is love a form of objective reality? Truth is a form of objective reality, is what objective reality is truth, which I'm bringing up with Schrödinger's equation. Excuse me. Cameron also was talking about in his artificial intelligence talk, he was talking about what we would call homogeneous knowledge and heterogeneous knowledge.
and heterogeneity and homogeneity, which he also talks about with path independence and path dependence. If something is path independent, it's conserved. It doesn't matter what path it took to get where it is. It is what it is, where it is, independently of the path taken to get there. That is a conservative field. Cameron is associating that with a homogeneous form of knowledge. Heterogeneity is, for example, heterogeneity is associated with non-conservative fields, which are path dependent. So it depends the path you took on where you get to. That is the quality or the potential of what you have at that particular position. If we look at it with heterogeneity, heterogeneity means two genus. Hetero is two, Greek for two, genus, two types. Homogeneous is one type. So if we have a paramecium as a life form, the paramecium as a life form has one type. It doesn't evolve very much or very long, but very, very ancient life form. It is neither male nor female. It has meiosis and mitosis and meiosis, rather, in cells splitting, and sometimes they come together, intermix genetic code, and split apart. Again, mostly splitting. It's almost pretty well a clone of itself, and it's a homogeneous life form. If we now have a heterogeneous life form, in other words, Mother Nature goes through an awful lot of trouble and creates two sexes, male and female. This is a heterogeneous life form. And evolution goes like a bat as soon as that happens. And the point that Cameron is making, as soon as you have this heterogeneous life forms or heterogeneous knowledge, what you then have is a path-dependent form, much more path-dependent. It's not conserved. Things are made up, like knowledge and experience, that wasn't there before. Things are created. Things can be destroyed. It's not a conservative field. Now we're talking about truth. And in talking about truth, we almost always assume it from a male point of view. Almost always. Philosophy, almost always from a male point of view. Alexia, what was the name of the woman in Egypt, the very famous?
I don't know.
Don't you remember?
No.
You studied her, remember?
Oh, I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay, Alicia? We'll look it up. We'll look it up and insert here.
Okay.
Then it comes to artificial intelligence. Okay, we're talking about Jane Austen. Jane Austen, what Tara is bringing to the table, what she was bringing in, is that Jane Austen is very definite, a female look at truth, because that is what women in England and that class would be talking about or living, and that was her life form, so it was very real. And that does not mean it is not interesting to men. Men are very interested in looking at it because it's an entirely different way of looking at it. For the number of people who were very much a fan of Jane Austen, supported her very much. Some people didn't, but wonderful male writers who supported her. If we now take a look at artificial intelligence as a breakthrough in technology and so forth, and has deep philosophical connotations to it, the one who really first formed a type of artificial intelligence was Mary Shelley in Frankenstein, because Frankenstein is his body is all taken apart, and, you know, dead body parts, which I guess that's, you know, rather than computer chips. But it was through electricity, they'd be jolted alive through electricity, that would bring this body to life. But it was a human-made life form in the same way as artificial intelligence. And the artificial intelligence community all looked to Frankenstein as, if you like, the template of where we're going with artificial intelligence. And it's a very moral book because it talks about the morality of Dr. Frankenstein with the monster who doesn't even have a name. And the real hero, I think, of the book is the monster's wife, who was never made, who was never actually created. It was started, but the wife wasn't there. And a lot of times, I think the goth movement is a dedication to the monster's wife, who doesn't exist. It is so meaningless, so not there, and so discredited that not only does not even have a name, but does not even exist. And therefore, that is the true hero of the book. Okay, that's how I interpret it. That's when I read it. That's how I interpret it. Oh, I see. The hero happens to be, it's a very feminist book because women are so discounted, they don't even exist, let alone have their viewpoints exist and so forth. So then I'm taking a look at philosophy, reality, and truth. Truth, now that I'm thinking of it, even though it's a sidebar from where I'm going, truth is, it has to have a heterogeneous aspect to it. It can't just be male truth or female truth. There's one truth, but it has different sides to it, as a female point of view and a male point of view. So looking at what I'm trying to prove is that this is not dependent on probability, because we look at there's two schools. One is a religious school, one is an atheist school. Look at the atheist school is very much dependent on a mathematics and a physics that is dependent on probability because it's non-causal. There's no causality to probability. It just sort of happens. So the whole physics is now derived from a non-causal type of mathematics, which is probability. It also means that there is no understanding of statistics and probability with that approach, but nevertheless, the reason is because there can't be a causality to it. If we go to applied mathematics and solution of differential equations, there is a causality to it. In other words, the physics follows the mathematics, and the mathematics are in well-defined forms that are not fuzzy. They're well-defined to the solution. They're actually solutions to differential equations. I don't know where femininity comes into it, but it's bloody important. So as a man, I sometimes ask the question, as a man, am I allowed to talk about feminism? And am I allowed to bring in a feminine point of view to what is truth and what is the reality of truth? I don't know. I feel very unqualified there. And I think that's a problem, and I think the world needs to be opened up more to good women mathematicians and good women philosophers. So what I'm looking at, the table of contents I've gone through, I started with a little theorem, which basically a little theorem counters Russell's paradox, which was the criteria of the atheist to show that there is no truth, that truth doesn't exist because all premises have a contradiction. So I'm disproving that. Equality, in chapter 2, equality then brings in, okay, let's start again with an axiomatic approach, equality being Euclid's first axiom. So we're proving that truth is, or actually disproving that truth is not, so that truth is. I'm looking at equality. I then talk more about Russell's paradox and the consequences of that. Then I'm bringing in the observer. Now, the observer is where we start to get something really absurd with the Copenhagen interpretation. And we really have to remove the Copenhagen interpretation. But in order to do that, I have to bring in the observer, that the universe may well be a conscious entity that is perceiving itself. And as things happen, it is reacting to events. Everything is reacting to events within the universe. And those things that react to events are observers, whether they be a photon of light or whether it be a stone. Jean-Paul Sartre now comes into play. We're bringing it a little bit more modern. After Niels Bohr and Schrodinger, Jean-Paul Sartre with the Second World War, because Sartre is the epitome of existentialism, where we're talking about it exists. That's it's almost like a premise that says it is, it's in existence, which is where Jean-Paul Sartre is coming from. I'm coming from it from an axiomatic point of view, developing Schrodinger's equation, showing the tie between Schrodinger's equation and the Einstein field equations. After Schrodinger's equation, we talk about Schrodinger's cat. And we talk about the field equations, the Einstein field equations. Bring that up because we're heading in that direction. Then we talk about a particle-photon gravitational interaction, which brings in Maxwell's equations. Because the three things in the unified field theory, Maxwell's equations, quantum mechanics, and gravity under the Einstein field equations. We talk about discussion, elastic collisions, and so forth, and calculations of general relativity. And then we get into this wonderful idea of string theory. Because you have said and pointed out that reality or physical reality is a result of the mathematics that determines the physical reality. Let's take a look at the mathematics. And then from the physical reality that comes out of it, we're seeing what we mean by truth, that it is. String theory, I think, is right. I think they gave up on it too soon. They're talking about things like superstring theory, which I think is completely wrong. But string theory, I think, is right. String theory is different than superstring theory. And string theory's got a lot going for it, in particular following the eigenvalues from Schrodinger's equation. And if you can match them to the Einstein field equations, now we've got something together. Oh, then I talk about galaxies in the unified field theory, because now we're getting to, in the next spiral structure of NGC 3198. Which is a spiral, a straight line. Now, that was a point where you and I really had a discussion looking at galactic structure when you finally began to come up with this wonderful conclusion of the mathematics determines reality and that there is order in the universe. And as soon as we see order in the universe, now this becomes incredibly powerful because that means there's a blueprint to the universe and the blueprint of the universe is mathematics. And that's Roxy's statement. And to me, Roxy's statement completely annihilates the Copenhagen interpretation. That's unbelievably important, particularly philosophically, in determining whether or not truth actually exists. So we look at the rotation curve and so forth with NGC 3198, which really proves that dark matter doesn't exist at all. It's a scam. It really is. And there's a mess of other stuff. And we can take a look at it. Also, by taking certain measurements, we know the universe is not expanding. So there is no dark matter. The universe is not expanding. And neutrinos travel at the speed of light. So personally, those are my three statements. The philosophy that we're looking at, I think results in our purpose here in where we're at and our purpose, that even though, okay, there is truth, this reality actually exists, so what? What does that mean? What are we supposed to do about it? Okay, it's sort of like one of the things is, okay, the truth is real, so we get to the center of everything. We claim to everybody and show through, the truth is real. Well, yeah, of course it is. Now what do you want us to do? And it's kind of like live your life accordingly. And does that make a change in our lives, knowing that truth is real, and that integrity is an objective form of reality? So after NGC 3198, go to chapter 13, which is, of course, an unlucky chapter. Then in chapter 14, we talk about 111 spiral galaxies. We can see the universe is not expanding. And if the universe is not expanding, the biggest question then coming, and this is important because we're looking at the universe as an infinite and eternal realm, and the reality and the truth is that we are living in an infinite and eternal realm, and we ourselves are transitory and finite. What role do we have to play in this? And that's where I will be going to take a look at this. But one of the biggest problems is the universe has to wind down after a while because of entropy. And we're seeing behavior of the galaxies, galactic centers, and very fast spinning black holes. And we bring in these equations that we've developed, and we can see that the galaxies are rejuvenating themselves, and it may be that galaxies are eternal. Galaxies were never formed. They always were. And all of this always was. But it's evolving. It is not steady state. So usually when they say there is no Big Bang and there is no expanding universe, usually the alternative is well, it must be steady state. But that's using the fallacy of the excluded middle. Suppose there is no steady state. Suppose the universe is dynamic and evolving and changing all the time. And at the same time, it's eternal and infinite and is not expanding at all. That is quite possible. And that's exactly what's going on. And, okay, we talk about entropy reversal and boundary conditions of Schrödinger's equation. And then the whole book here is chapter 16 and basically concludes with Roxy's statement, which is your statement, that mathematics determines the physical reality in which we live. Hypatia. Her name was Hypatia. She was killed. She's a martyr. Well, now move forward and I'll give you this talk from Cameron Rout regarding artificial life and his thoughts and comments on artificial on AI and artificial intelligence and the blockchain. Thank you.
The concept of joining artificial intelligence with blockchain technology has some interesting ramifications. On one hand, we have a technology that is capable of replicating the instantaneous thought of humans, perhaps currently on a relatively trivial level, but at scale can create some interesting results. On the other hand, we have a technology that's capable of replicating the path dependency of human behavior and thought, and that is blockchain. And between the two, we have the capability of emulating particular aspects of humanity that haven't really been explored in the media that I've been exposed to. For example, the concept of a robot which can think and work for itself is thought of as an entity which is reliant on human factors, such as the production of the parts, the programming of its software, and its ability to navigate the world is dependent on the human environment around it, having to recharge itself, etc. And that's the physical manifestation of a robot, for example, exploring the world. Blockchains have the capability of have an interesting capability that has been made possible by cryptographic tools like the Enigma protocol, for example, which allows algorithms to be developed and tested with data without actually exposing the algorithm itself. So let me give you an example. I put together a trading algorithm that's capable of analyzing elements of the blockchain, like, say, cryptocurrencies, and allocating resources between them to create a profit, a trading algorithm, so to speak. And this trading algorithm has the ability to generate revenue for the source, whoever wrote the code. Some percentage of the returns goes to the source, and the rest of the percentage goes to the owners of the capital that have invested in this algorithm. And this results in a annuity for, you know, people investing in this algorithm. And this is really neat because we can then, someone can publish that they have an algorithm that returns a certain amount. You can take that algorithm, run it on your own test data, so that you become confident in its ability to generate returns without actually seeing the code. You invest in it, and then the blockchain script sends money back to you, etc. So you can imagine this model being quite interesting and a new and fascinating aspect of blockchain tech, because we have and we don't have to involve we eliminate the counterparty risk in that type of analysis. Now, when you take this a few steps down the road, it gets interesting pretty quickly. So imagine, these algorithms are run on, let's say these algorithms are run on smart contracts on a blockchain like the Ethereum blockchain, and are or at least executed on the blockchain. It gets complicated if you get into actually where it's stored and how it runs, etc. But for the sake of simplicity, you can imagine that there is a algorithm that is executed on the blockchain and is capable of making a return to particular addresses, etc. Now, what's interesting is if you combine this with the idea of artificial intelligence and you create those algorithms to be intelligent algorithms that are capable of creating new algorithms, which is not that crazy of an idea to create an algorithm that creates algorithms, especially with something like trading software that's quite simple. And trading software, as far as the type of thought, it's not simple in the actual analysis, but it only has limited functions. You know, move capital from here to here, move capital from here to here. And that's about the level of sophistication in what it has to do in the outputs. The type of analysis that goes into it can be more complicated. And so perhaps we have an algorithm that is programmed every block to generate new algorithms, take the winning algorithm and then learn from it, and then write its own program into the next algorithm. There's nothing stopping a contract from actually writing a contract. That's totally fine. So we can have one contract in the blockchain, creating a new block contract for the sake of generating revenue, and you can create these tendrils, so to speak, over time that are trying to come up with better ways of reallocating capital and sending the dividends back to the original source, which eventually makes its way back to the original investor. So this is really interesting because if those, what would make sense is for those algorithms to become competitive. And so we have a Darwinian process of capital allocation where the, you know, each generation may breed several new algorithms which are capable of creating return, and if any of them beat the original algorithm dies, and the one, you know, producing more returns, etc., so on and so forth. And so we have this Darwinian process of artificial intelligence generating new, increasingly improved algorithms for generating return. Now, what's interesting is usually this type of thing is thought of, it would eventually run out of steam, but this type of algorithm would actually build steam as it goes, because the ability to generate profits is actually increasingly funding the research, so to speak, so that a blockchain algorithm will be able to fund more explorations in each particular block if it's successful. And so these blockchain algorithms become surprisingly similar to organisms. Without actually being very sophisticated organisms, they're sort of the equivalent of the first in the primordial soup, you know, the first organisms to learn how to duplicate their own information in a path-dependent way. And that's why the path dependency is so important, because that's what gives them independence from humanity. So as long as the blockchain is alive and runs itself, these algorithms are free to fund themselves and give themselves the juice to perpetuate themselves. And the idea is such an algorithm would generate profits that are returned with some value to the person who built it now, or invested in it along the way, etc., and provide value. But what's interesting is it's possible that someone could create such an algorithm without programming a backdoor or a kill switch, so to speak, for the algorithm. It could be entirely self-sustaining and highly competitive. So we may have some that are, you know, utility blockchain robots that go out and are allocating capital for return, and we may have some that are just for fun. It could be for benevolent purposes or malicious purposes, it doesn't really matter, but I'm sure some programmer could build one of these machines to operate itself on the blockchain with no intent to disperse the capital that it's accumulated. So it's possible that we have an organism that, you know, block after block is learning how to accumulate capital for itself with no intent of necessarily giving it back to any particular person. Now, it may be in its best interest to not hoard capital because it doesn't, you don't necessarily get a return on hoarding that capital on the blockchain. So it may be incentivized to reinvest it for the sake of a return through these algorithms, so to speak. But it isn't necessarily accountable to anyone. And that's the really interesting thing. So the kernel of life as we know it, you know, we think of artificial intelligence, like for example, Sundar's presentation of the Duplex software at Google's I/O, where he was able to beat the Turing test. Well, I don't know if that, some people would argue it's not actually defeating the Turing test, but it's a landmark in the in that test, in the Turing test. A person did talk to a robot in a relatively sophisticated conversation and didn't know they were talking to a robot. So we can see that it's not far before, you know, maybe a true Turing test is defeated. But that does not capture the importance of the path dependency. And if we have this other organism living in the blockchain, even if it is a relatively simple organism, it's based on the concept of heterogeneity and the heterogeneity of resources, which is the basis of life's definition in the need for information to perpetuate itself in a heterogeneous way. So the concept of having a blockchain algorithm duplicating itself in a simple manner is actually just as interesting, if not more interesting, than the ability to communicate with human beings, because over time, we may have multiple of these algorithms that are allocating capital and reallocating capital for the sake of an improved return, funding themselves to get larger, and actually potentially using that funding to improve that artificial intelligence, which could evolve in ways beyond simply allocating capital. It could have interesting long-term results, especially if that progress is assisted by people, where these genetic algorithms that are able to reproduce themselves in this Darwinian process are, if human beings are contributing to this process and upgrading that artificial intelligence to have more capabilities, then it may even accelerate that process where those capabilities are more advanced, and we have a very interesting relationship between humans outside the blockchain and humans and this artificial life, so to speak, more so than artificial intelligence in the blockchain. This all stays in the realm of you know, an interesting academic exercise until you get to the point where the blockchain is the bridge between the blockchain and the outside world is bridged. And that could happen with the integration of algorithms and blockchain technologies in construction, so to speak, so that you know, these self-learning blockchain algorithms could be also used in manufacturing processes, in energy generation, etc., and more integrated into the real world, where it may become increasingly difficult to turn them off. And so if we eventually have a you know, a world in which a manufacturing process or 3D printed parts, etc., are capable of being produced, you know, autonomously by a being, so to speak, a simple organism on the blockchain that is capable of making capital, we may train such a algorithm to build devices, market them on social media, and sell them and ship them, etc. We're very close to an automated supply chain for many consumer products, and we could actually have that process eventually be run entirely by an autonomous system. And if those autonomous systems are not accountable or responsible outside of the blockchain, then they are only accountable to themselves, and we basically have created you know, a force in the world that is you know, at a maybe a next level of science fiction, so to speak, that is a lot more similar to a world that is that where we interact with artificial life. And as opposed to artificial intelligence. But even though artificial intelligence is at the core of it, it's not about, you know, necessarily being able to speak with it, although that could easily be one of the implications, is that autonomous blockchain robots develop the ability to interact with the outside world through voice, etc., through human interaction, which could also make for an interesting relationship. So that is basically how I think we end up with a world where, you know, we as humans end up coexisting with an artificial life form that is a lot more interesting than just a artificial intelligence system that's designed to be as much like interacting with a human, as opposed to something that has evolved for itself into something that has a relationship with humans. And what is even more interesting about that is, what is the difference between such an organism and a you know, human or animal organism, and what are the, how does that change the way that we think of or fear artificial intelligence? Is there an opportunity for it to have a conscience, so to speak? If it's only accountable to itself, does that mean it also has the ability to control that or have agency over its actions, and therefore meet many of the requirements that people may impose on humans for a soul, so to speak, is the concept of agency. I don't know, it's more complicated than that, but it's definitely an interesting topic.
Thanks for listening, everybody. If you liked what you heard, you may subscribe in your podcast provider and perhaps share in various social media sites. Bruce has promised he won't change the links anymore and screw up trying to find the next episode. Please enjoy the rest of your day and may everything work out for the best. We try to have a new podcast every Saturday, so see you next week.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.